Hello and welcome to the A-Level Politics Show. It's the 1st of June 2023 and we are getting nearer, if you are in the upper sixth, year 13, second year of A-Levels, to your paper 2 exam. One of the key ways to be successful in this paper is to understand what the executive does, what Parliament does, how they try to control each other, and the set of circumstances that allow one to dominate and challenge the work of the opposing branch. So what is the question? I'm going to pick one question that was asked back in 2021. Evaluate the view that since 2010, the executive has dominated Parliament. My direction is that it hasn't, not entirely anyway, and that there is pushback from Parliament. I'll start my focus on the powers, tools and methods that the executive has to control the Parliament. In my second paragraph, I will analyse the methods that Parliament enjoys, the tools, the powers that Parliament has, bringing in the House of Lords as well, since that's half of Parliament, to control the executive. So don't forget, Parliament is the House of Commons and the House of Lords. Mention both. Then I'll end by considering in my third paragraph, my third section, the type of circumstances that will affect just how one branch is able to control the other, concluding that currently Sunak's government is pretty weak despite its strong parliamentary majority. So, here goes. Okay, so paragraph one. There are those who claim, mistakenly in my view, that the executive has a range of advantages, powers and tools to control Parliament. It, for example, proposes legislation and most of Parliament's time is taken up with the consideration of these bills rather than, say, private members' bills, which are brought by backbench MPs. The government enjoys a mandate from the people in a general election to enact the legislative programme contained in its manifesto. Hence why in 2022, the government scrapped the Fixed Terms Parliament Act in the Dissolution and Calling of Parliaments Act, which returned the decision on when to call an election to the Prime Minister. Advantage executive. This was something that was promised, contained in the Tory party manifesto, so it got through Parliament relatively unscathed. The executive also proposes a budget which nearly always sails through Parliament, and the government gets to decide what goes into these finance bills. For example, the 2022 Finance Act extended tax relief for orchestras, museums, galleries and exhibitions. Government can also take actions without parliamentary approval, and if one branch can go it alone, then that demonstrates real power. The way it can do this is through the royal prerogative. There are other ways too, and I'll come to those in a sec, but it can do this through the royal prerogative. These are powers that were once those of the monarch that have now passed to the Prime Minister. Along with the right to call an election, it consists of the Prime Minister acting as the de facto commander-in-chief of the armed forces. In theory, the Prime Minister can declare war. In theory, I'll come back to why in practice that's not the case. But the Prime Minister is also the de facto, in all but name, chief diplomat and can shape international relations how they see fit. Despite parliamentary concerns about Saudi Arabia's human rights record, for example, we now know through investigatory journalism and use of the Freedom of Information Act that Boris Johnson and the Johnson government sought to maintain a close relationship with Saudi Arabia and even promised and even promoted its takeover of Newcastle United Football Club. And that was without parliamentary knowledge. Sunak has sought perhaps a different tone in his dealings with the EU to Johnson, seeking to address the problems of the Northern Ireland Protocol with the Windsor Agreement in March 2023. And that leads back to my initial point, that the Prime Minister is the chief diplomat and steers international policy in the direction they want rather than in the direction perhaps that Parliament wants. Along with the royal prerogative, the Prime Minister enjoys immense power of patronage, allowing them to fill their cabinet with who they want, so long as those guys sit in Parliament. And they tie loyalty to, they tie loyalty in Parliament to a promotion to a ministerial job. Hence why so many MPs might vote against their better angels to side with the executive on a range of matters that they might otherwise oppose. They want that ministerial car. The Public Order Act 2023 restricted the right to protest, a fundamental right. Yet only one Tory MP, David Davies, who perhaps no longer has an interest in serving in government, voted against the law. It was rushed through in time for the King's coronation with minimal scrutiny in the House of Commons. To this end, the whips did their job. The whips are those who instill party discipline and persuade wavering backbenchers to vote along with their party and with the government if they are from the governing party. Former Chief Whip Gavin Williamson was purported to have said of an MP who needed help with financial difficulties, "Tell him I owe him." No, that's not what he said. He said, "Tell him." No, yes, that is what he said. He said, "Tell him I own him. I own him." I thought I said owe him. I'll start that again, shall I? Former Chief Whip Gavin. I'm going to start it again. Former Chief Whip Gavin Williamson was purported to have said to an MP who needed help with financial difficulties, "Tell him I own him." What a lovely man Gavin Williamson is. Another such way the executive can control Parliament is through secondary legislation or what some might call statutory instruments. These are powers given to ministers in primary legislation that allow them to make minor changes to the law without parliamentary say-so. Many are concerned that these powers returning to the UK following Brexit, say on fishing quotas, will bypass Parliament and simply be wielded by government in the form of these statutory instruments, or SIs. They have been collectively referred to as Henry VIII powers, since they seem to give the government authority over large swathes of policy without parliamentary consent. Well over 600 SIs were made to give effect to Brexit, according to the UCL's Constitution Unit, and around 500 in relation to the COVID pandemic. Yet there are limits to all of these powers and advantages that the executive has over Parliament. Bills not contained in the government's manifesto will face greater scrutiny, particularly in the House of Lords. The illegal immigration bill is currently being carefully examined by the House of Lords at the time of recording. The chamber is expected to raise concerns about the detention of children and vulnerable people who arrive in small boats and push for the Home Office to publish an impact assessment of the legislation. While the government can control the budget, it is also subject to far greater scrutiny when a budget is mishandled. George Osborne's so-called Omnishambles budget, because it had so many policies that were odd or reversed, had to be unpicked owing to a number of unpopular policies, including a tax on Cornish pasties. And Kwasi Kwarteng's mini-budget in autumn 2022 resulted in a run on sterling, and many of the measures had to be dropped as international markets raised alarm that the proposed tax cuts were unfunded. It ultimately resulted in Kwarteng's sacking and Truss eventually having to resign also, as she lost support of her parliamentary colleagues in Parliament. We also know that there are limits to patronage and limits to the royal prerogative. Prime ministers must take into account the levels of parliamentary support that they enjoy and acknowledge potential areas of parliamentary opposition. Sunak appointed Suella Braverman as Home Secretary just days after she had been sacked by Truss for breaking the ministerial code to shore up support from the new right backbenchers in Parliament. Regarding the royal prerogative more broadly, it is unthinkable that a government would take the country to war without parliamentary approval, not since Blair set the precedent for doing so over Iraq and Cameron allowed two votes on action in Syria, one of which he lost. We may see that the executive relies on whips to instill party discipline, as I mentioned earlier, but the job is becoming far more difficult as a culture of rebelling against the government from the government's own backbench MPs appears to have taken root. We see that on the illegal immigration bill itself. New right Tories wanted it to include a commitment to withdraw from the ECHR. We see it on fracking, on the role of Huawei and the rollout of 5G. This culture began perhaps with Brexit or a campaign to have an EU referendum and reached its nadir in the rejection of Theresa May's Brexit deal by 230 votes, a record in parliamentary history. It continued with the disquiet over breaking a manifesto commitment to not raise national insurance to pay for the COVID backlog in the NHS, eventually leading to the government U-turning and ditching the tax rise last year in 2022. Finally, when it comes to secondary legislation, the House of Lords often scrutinises primary legislation and questions, examines whether ministers should be given powers to lay down specific statutory instruments. In May 2023, the Lords defeated the government over the retained EU law bill, adding amendments that would, if accepted, allow the scrapping of EU laws, many of which were written into UK law, only once they face scrutiny in parliamentary committees. More on parliamentary committees and the tools that Parliament has after this break. I've given you a lot of different tools and powers and advantages that the executive has. As I mentioned before, you don't have to write about all of them. And the same for this section. I'm going to be speaking about a lot of powers and tools that Parliament has to fight back against the executive. Maybe you can list a few and then write about one in detail, say committees. So let's start with what I am arguing is the weak argument, that Parliament faces many constraints on its ability to hold the executive to account. The committee system in Parliament is weak. Public bill committees, committees that examine a bill line by line and suggest amendments, are ineffective because government whips can completely dominate proceedings, with the committee majority accepting only government amendments. Over 99% of ministerial amendments succeed, while the success rate for non-government amendments to bills is below 1%. Bill committees are involved at the later stages of the legislative process, once there has already been a Commons vote at the second reading. So they are not there crafting and shaping legislation. They are there perhaps to do the government's bidding. While these committees are able to table amendments, these are often, as I said earlier, friendly to the government. Meanwhile, select committees established to provide detailed scrutiny of government departments can make only advisory recommendations and have no power to amend the law, unlike their US counterparts in Congress in the US. Let's turn to parliamentary questions. These can also be ineffective. We're going to focus on Prime Minister's questions first. Now, these have been described as a Punch and Judy show by David Cameron. Governments often ask their own backbenchers easy questions or planted questions, which the Prime Minister can simply bat away. Even urgent questions have been undermined by a focus on image rather than substance. A junior minister is often sent to answer urgent questions rather than the Secretary of State. In January 2022, Boris Johnson sent his Paymaster General to answer an urgent question relating to lockdown parties at Number 10. Opposition MP shouted, "Where is he?" and shame to no avail. And then we have votes of confidence. A vote of confidence is rarely used, and a government with a majority will always survive it. Apart from in 1979, but then Labour didn't have a majority at that stage. The official opposition has the right to call for a vote of confidence at any point. The government, by convention, must make time for this debate. But no Prime Minister has ever been removed in a vote of confidence. Opposition days are days allocated, and this is another tool. Opposition days are days allocated in the House of Commons for the discussion of subjects chosen by the opposition, but they only have 20 allocated days per year. And the government can usually rely on its inbuilt Commons majority to defeat motions, whether it's on votes of confidence or whether it's on opposition motions. In recent years, MPs from the governing party have simply abstained from voting if they felt they were going to lose a vote. And then we turn to the House of Lords. As I mentioned, we have to mention the House of Lords. So there are limits to the House of Lords scrutiny role. The Parliament Act 1949 limits its power to that of a one-year delay, after which the government-dominated Commons can force through legislation. The Salisbury Convention bars the Lords from examining legislation contained in the government's manifesto, and rules on financial privilege from the 1911 Parliament Act exist for this reason that the Salisbury Convention does. The House of Lords is not elected. It lacks legitimacy. Therefore, the Lords cannot block a budget. Yet, the tools mentioned here can often be used in a way that puts the executive on the spot and allows Parliament to flex its muscles. Let's return back to public bill committees. Arguably, they provide a useful role in amending legislation. During the legislative process, most bills are sent to a committee stage when a group of at least 11 MPs consider the proposed act clause by clause in detail. And then we have select committees, and they have become fiercely independent. This is where the real scrutiny is. This is where the government is really put on the spot. Following the right committee reforms, chairs are now elected by their fellow MPs in a secret ballot rather than chosen by party whips, a move which has increased that independence. Now, chairing select committees has become a viable alternative career route to a career as a minister, requiring far less blind loyalty to the party in power. Chris Bryant, chair of the Parliamentary Standards Committee, has seemingly given up a career on the Labour front bench and opted instead for a role that involves intricate scrutiny of MPs' behaviour. In 2021, he was at the forefront of criticising MPs for having second jobs. Select committee members build up worthwhile expertise in their policy area. Tom Tugendhat, chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, brought his experience of serving in the military and of working in the Middle East to the role as chair. Other committees also contribute to valuable scrutiny. The Privileges Committee is currently looking into whether Boris Johnson lied to Parliament over Partygate. The Liaison Committee consists of all of the select committee chairs and grills the Prime Minister twice yearly on all manner of topics. Let's turn back to parliamentary questions. Urgent questions are a particularly useful way of scrutinising the government. As well as tabling written and oral parliamentary questions, MPs can ask these urgent questions or request that they be tabled when they believe an issue requires an immediate government response. And the Speaker has been pretty open to allowing these urgent questions. And then let's move to this idea of votes of no confidence or censure motions. These can seriously weaken a government and a prime minister. Now, while a parliamentary vote of no confidence in a government has little chance of passing if a government has a majority, or even a parliamentary vote on a leader or a prime minister has little chance of passing, a party vote of no confidence, that is when the government's own party votes in its leader, that can seriously damage a government. Boris Johnson had to face a party vote of no confidence in his leadership, which was called for by his own backbenchers in June 2022, following Partygate and following the Chris Pincher affair. Now, while he survived that vote, 148 out of the 359 Tory MPs voted to remove him, a significant minority. His authority lay in tatters thereafter. Opposition days can also put pressure on the government and force them to account for a policy or to change course. The debates are usually followed by a non-binding vote which seeks to put pressure on a government to change policy. They can also seek to divide the governing party. Labour's Opposition Day motion on fracking in October 2022 sparked chaos on the Tory backbenches and was mishandled badly by party whips. It contributed to the resignation of Liz Truss as Prime Minister the next day. And then we can come to the House of Lords, finally. Now, yes, it has limits on its power, but it's become far more effective at scrutinising the government. It has been particularly effective recently due to the absence of a Conservative majority now that the hereditary peers have been removed in the House of Lords. The crossbenchers, most of whom are chosen by the House of Lords Appointments Commission due to achievements outside politics, have gained pivotal status and hold the balance of power in the chamber. The House of Lords has proved particularly willing to take the government to task over the rights of vulnerable groups and over the protection of civil liberties. This was evident when the government suffered multiple defeats on its policing bill in January 2022, a bill that had largely sailed through the government-dominated Commons. So we can see, therefore, that the tools that Parliament has to keep the executive in check can and often do work. Finally, I'm going to focus on the circumstances that will benefit one branch over the other. I'll start with those circumstances that will benefit the executive over Parliament. If a government has a large majority, it usually can dominate Parliament. Johnson was able to get Brexit done owing to the 80-seat majority he won in 2019. If the ruling party is united, then it will have an even better chance of passing its legislation and dominating Parliament. Johnson removed the whip from 20 or so Remain MPs, and that allowed him to replace them in the 2019 general election with Brexit-supporting candidates, allowing the party to limit its divides over the issue of Brexit. And then if you have an opposition that's divided, the government will get away with things that it perhaps didn't think it could. Labour MPs called for a vote of confidence in Jeremy Corbyn after the 2016 EU referendum, which meant that the party was navel-gazing at the very time when it should have been scrutinising what the government was doing on Brexit. And then we turn to the leader. If the leader of the governing party has authority, again, it can dominate Parliament. Thatcher and Blair were seen as strong leaders who commanded loyalty. Blair said of Major, "I lead my party, he follows his." Yet, circumstances change. A majority is only useful if the ruling party isn't divided. Over COVID Plan B measures introduced in the winter of 2021-22, over national insurance rises, over illegal immigration and over the trust budget, Tory prime ministers have struggled to avoid rebellions in their own party. A united opposition can really challenge the government. Keir Starmer has imposed authority on the Parliamentary Labour Party, for example, by removing the whip from left-wingers who might cause trouble, such as Corbyn and Diane Abbott. A decent set of local election results in May 2023 also seems to have boosted Starmer's control over his party, while nervous Tories have started bickering again amongst themselves. We see this with the National Conservative Conference held in May 2023, attended by Home Secretary Suella Braverman, who seems to burnish a real desire to be Prime Minister one day. And she seemed to be leaning into the culture wars at that conference to appeal to the right of her party and establishing herself as a challenger to Sunak, probably after the next election if the Tories lose, but you never know, maybe before it. And that brings me on to Sunak. Yes, a leader may have authority. Blair and Thatcher had authority, certainly for the early years of their tenure. But a leader may lack authority, and straight from the off, they may lack authority. Theresa May, after the 2017 election, was described as a dead woman walking by George Osborne. Truss, after her mini budget, well, she survived just a few days longer, didn't she? And Sunak. Now, as Starmer said, Sunak lost the Tory leadership campaign to Truss, who herself had lost to a wet lettuce. Now, if you don't know about this story, Google Truss and wet lettuce. But Sunak has not faced a general election and therefore lacks some legitimacy. So if we are to look at current circumstances, and politics is a current affairs subject, I would say the majority notwithstanding, we currently have a parliament that is pretty assertive against the executive, and the executive is pretty weak at the moment anyway. So we're coming to the end of this podcast now. Let's just summarise. The executive at first sight appears to have the upper hand over Parliament, and on a day-to-day basis, that's probably true. It is the government that draws up and initiates legislation, private members' bills notwithstanding. Yet there are constraints on all of its powers, especially if a policy is mismanaged. Parliament appears to be more assertive, especially in the past year or so, where it has effectively moved two prime ministers from office. The circumstances after the 2019 election, which so heavily favoured executive power, have withered somewhat as the ruling party lacks direction and the opposition appears to be getting its act together. Things can, of course, change, especially if you are listening to this in 2024. But right now, it is 2023, and it's clear that we have a weak government and a parliament that is willing to fight a bit more than it used to. That's important for democracy. Now, thanks for listening to this epic feature-length episode. If you liked what you hear, subscribe to Plus 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 for all the extras, two bonus pods like this one each month, exclusive listening rights to EG for Me, our breaking news service that helps you apply recent examples to essay questions, and for access to the complete full back catalogue. Once you are done listening here, why not also take part in our episode poll? This one, after this podcast, is straightforward. Which branch controls the other, Parliament or the Executive? You've heard what I think. Now over to you. Until the next time, take care. Bye-bye.